This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Viruses are the sources of many diseases. That's actually their only purpose, to infect and replicate. But even though they're the cause of many illnesses, when it comes down to it, they're pretty simple and they're pretty small. Just a coating surrounding genetic material. But there are a class of giant viruses. They contain 100 times more genes than the normal virus. They're so big, some of them can almost reach the size, the same size as bacteria. And there's a debate surrounding how exactly these viruses evolved. Did they come from some unknown cellular ancestor, or are they beefed up versions of smaller viruses? The genome of giant viruses found in a wastewater treatment plant in Austria has now been studied to help unravel this mystery. The research was published this week in the journal Science. Frederick Schulz is an author on that study. He's also a bioinformatics postdoctoral fellow at the Department of Energy's Joint Genome Institute, part of the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab in Walnut Creek, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. It's a great pleasure to be in the program.
Well, it's very nice to have you. Thank you. So I said that viruses are made of two things. There's a protein shell and genetic material. How did giant viruses beef up then to get so big?
Yes, that's a very intriguing question. And I think many researchers were thinking about this in the last one or two decades since giant viruses were first discovered. And as it was very unexpected, as you said it already, viruses usually are very streamlined organisms, very streamlined. They really have genes only to the absolute necessary things to do an effective infection of the host and replicate inside of the host. And you would not expect to find that many genes in a viral genome. So yes. There are different ideas how giant viruses become so big.
Now, there's one idea that these giant viruses evolved into what they're calling a fourth domain, that maybe there's a new branch on the tree of life. To tell us a little bit about that idea and what the other ideas might be.
Sure. So the question is, if there is a fourth domain, and there were ideas that giant viruses originated from cellular organisms, as it just seems so unlikely to accumulate so many genes, which are usually found in cellular organisms. And so the more likely approach would have been that these viruses indeed came from a cellular organism, that they evolved from a cellular organism. And this cellular organism could have been part of a elusive fourth domain of life, which we did not sample yet, which we did not discover yet, and which eventually is already extinct. So researchers thought, well, this could be the explanation that we find these certain cellular genes in giant viruses. So they postulated, these giant viruses might be remnants, or they might just represent such a fourth domain of life.
Is that what you think? And
I think when we first discovered this new group of viruses and we saw that they have such a much more comprehensive complement of these genes typically found in cellular organisms, really wanted to prove this and really wanted to show that they come from the cellular ancestor, because it just sounds super cool. And we really like this idea. And I heard talks from Chantal Abergel, who is at the University in Marseille and who did a lot of amazing work with giant viruses in the last 10-15 years. And I really admired this idea, and I thought, now we have some kind of chance to really prove this. And we kind of are not from the giant virus field, so we came into this study rather unbiased. And in the end, I think what we found just didn't give us any support for this fourth domain of life hypothesis.
And so you analyzed the genetic material of four new species of giant viruses. And what's the general name we give to these viruses?
So we gave them the name Klosnovirus. So as you already said, they were initially discovered in a sample from a wastewater treatment plant in Klosterneuburg, Austria. And based on the genetic material we found in there, we made use of these genes to screen through like thousands of environmental metagenomic data sets, and we found related viruses in I think around 50 of these data sets, and three of them they had these viral genomes in very good quality inside, and those we took for a comparative analysis, and it seems that they are all the closest relatives to Klosnovirus. So based on that, we could define this new group of giant viruses, which we then called Klosnoviruses, as they are based on the site where the first one was discovered.
So you think that these giant viruses may have grown in size as they evolved, as they went along picking up other remnants?
So this is one factor, picking up other like genes from, let's say, foreign genetic material which can come from the host. So we should keep in mind these giant viruses, they, at least the ones we know today, they infect protists. So these are like unicellular eukaryotes, like very small, partially rather primitive cells, and they thrive inside these cells. And protists, they take up a lot of other organisms in the surroundings. They take up bacteria, fungi, other protists. They take up viruses and they digest all this. So a lot of genetic material is set free in these protists. And giant viruses are also in there. And giant viruses, they can persist in this protist cytoplasm. And one idea was that due to all this big pool of DNA, it's more likely to take up genes. And there seem to be some mechanisms which allow the integration of these genes into the giant virus genome. But actually, it's not that simple. It's just one thing to acquire a new gene. But giant viruses, they also extensively duplicate these genes. So they start generate multiple copies of this gene in the genome, and they evolve these genes. And some get thrown out again, and others maybe evolve with additional important function or beneficial functions in host interaction.
Wow, so they say they suck up all this genetic material, they grow giant, and they spit out what they don't need to keep going.
Mm-hmm. And so that's the idea.
Idea. But you actually haven't found the virus itself, have you? You found like signs and remnants of the virus? Do you have to go fishing now back to that cesspool of the waste treatment place and find the real virus?
Sure, I think that would be the best thing to do, and I think it's being done right now by a collaborator at the University of Vienna. But it's not so easy to do it. So the thing is, as I said, these giant viruses are usually found in protists. And previous giant viruses, they have been isolated usually in co-cultivation with protists. So as often these native hosts of the giant viruses are not accessible for isolation. Maybe we don't have the right conditions to get them. So it's very tricky to isolate them. And also the giant viruses often are very lytic to the host, so they might just destroy the host population in a short period of time. So the idea is usually they take a sample from the environment and they destroy all cellular material in there, something like using strong heat or so, and the viruses, they survive. And then they take the sample and they put it on a culture of, like, let's say, amoebae, and some giant viruses are able to infect this amoebae, and that's how they isolate these giant viruses. But it seems that for Klosnovirus, this doesn't work in that way. So because they have never been isolated before, even based on our environmental survey, it seems that they're fairly abundant. So as I said, we found them in 50 samples all over the world.
A lot of people say, why do you care about a giant virus? I mean, the part that it's giant, people like giant things. Why should you? What's so interesting about it to you?
I think to me it was most exciting to see that how close viruses can actually become to cellular organisms. And as you already said, I think the most striking part, I still remember during my master's studies at the University of Vienna, I had a course where I had to present a study about mimivirus, and I was so fascinated by it to see that these kind of viruses can exist. And so I was really struck by this, seeing what viruses are capable of and that they can come so close to cellular life with the genetic equipment. So it was that I think makes it really exciting to see. And from an evolutionary perspective, it's really a great thing to study giant viruses.
As you say, that we only discovered them about like 10 years or so ago, but we all thought that viruses were very small. Could there now be many more giant viruses out there we don't know about because we never looked for them because we thought they were so small?
I think one problem was in the past that when they try to isolate viruses, they usually use filtration, so they take all particles which are fairly small, which pass through a filter, and that's like their viral fraction, and this has been studied. And giant viruses, they won't pass the filter because of their particle size. So I think in many previous studies, they got missed. And I think also upon the first discovery of giant viruses, it was not so clear that these are indeed viruses, and it was expected that these are bacteria because of their size. And only later, when they used something like electron microscopy, they saw that these look like viruses. And I think viruses, giant viruses out there, that's for sure that there are many, many more. And in the course of this study, I surveyed, I think, around 6,000 to 7,000 metagenomes, and from environmental samples all over the world. And I saw that there are really like many, many giant viruses. And as I said, the problem is the cultivation, that the ones we know, usually they could be cultivated with the host. But I think the majority, they are not so easily accessible for cultivation. And data-driven studies are the best, I guess.
What is the evolutionary advantage of being a bigger virus over a smaller virus?
That is a great question. And we thought a lot about it because this new group of giant viruses, they have almost complete set of translation system genes. So this is kind of a thing what we would not expect in a virus. And it's one of the criteria we thought viruses definitely don't do translation. And we don't have any evidence that Closnovirus or the newly discovered viruses do it. But it might be imaginable that under certain conditions in the environment, for example, starvation of a host population, where the host metabolism gets slowed down, that in that case, this giant virus with such a genetic complement could take over the translation inside of the host cell. So they could eventually use the ribosome of the host and use their own genes, like the viral the viral proteins, to build up additional viral proteins. So they could keep up replicating while the host slows down. Alternatively, there was the idea that a defense strategy, which we observe in eukaryotic cells, also in bacteria, is that upon viral infection by viruses, that they shut down protein biosynthesis just to avoid further propagation of the virus. And one conceivable scenario could be that Closnovirus, for example, in that case starts using its own proteins to build up additional proteins inside of the host cell.
Fascinating.
So these are really exciting questions, I think, but we really would need to isolate Closnovirus first together with its host to follow this up.
I hope you have a very successful fishing expedition out there to find the virus. Thank you very much. Frederick Schultz is bioinformatics postdoctoral fellow at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab at the Department of Energy Joint Genome Institute. We're going to take a break and come back. We think we know about Lyme disease. Well, what you think you know might not be true. We're going to have some experts to set the thing straight. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The search for extraterrestrial intelligence is a key theme of movie depictions of astronomy. But in the real world, SETI generally hasn't received tons of funding. But 2 years ago, investor and science philanthropist Yuri Milner said he wanted to pour $100 million into SETI research as part of the Breakthrough Listen Project. Science Friday's Charles Berquist visited the Green Bank Observatory in West Virginia, one of the places that's listening for ET.
As you wind through the hills of the Potomac Highlands in eastern West Virginia, you pass a few antique stores, farms, an occasional logging truck, and signs for a ski resort further up the road. At a certain point, radio reception falls away.
A lot of static there, a scan.
We'll send you a notice.
Station 550 AM here. Now the radio is scanning.
It provides even an
additional
layer of protection.
And we're back to 550, so...
But I do need to say one thing. You said
one station on the AM band here.
And as you enter the town of Green Bank, West Virginia, population 143, you might notice something unusual. The rim of a huge dish peeking over the hills behind the elementary school.
To travel for many miles through just a very natural environment and then come upon this... really high-tech view, this outer spacey vision. It's just beautiful.
That's Mike Holstein, an engineer responsible for the business operations of that outer spacey vision, the Green Bank Telescope, or GBT. While it looks a bit like the backyard satellite dishes some people use to get TV reception, the GBT is huge. They call it a 100-meter telescope, but that really doesn't do it justice.
It's big. It's made up of about 2,200 panels, each panel being about the size of a mattress. So the reflector surface is 2.3 acres.
That 2.3 acres collects faint radio signals across a wide swath of the electromagnetic spectrum, wavelengths from 2.6 millimeters up to 3 meters, and focuses them down onto instruments sitting in a spot just a few inches in size. Dr. Karen O'Neill is the director of the Green Bank Observatory. She says every minute on the telescope is spoken for, for projects like one that looks at the wispy clouds of gas around galaxies.
People who do computational astronomy have built these beautiful maps that everybody sees showing the universe's clumps and filaments all connected together, and they're absolutely gorgeous, but they're computer simulations. We need to go get the data to show that these computer simulations are right. It's the only telescope in the world that can detect this diffuse gas. There is no other telescope that has a combination of sensitivity and instruments to go and do it.
Closer to home, it can look at individual planets. It's been used to take pictures of comets. And it can look for the energy given off by the vibrations of specific molecules, things like basic sugars floating in space.
We found these just out anywhere that you have a lot of energy in space. We discovered you could have basic sugars.
The telescope has also detected prebiotic molecules, and recently chiral molecules, the left or right-handed molecules necessary for life as we know it on Earth. But if those molecular building blocks are common, what about intelligent life? The observatory has a history with the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, or SETI. Astronomer Frank Drake first set down the equation scientists use to ballpark the probability of finding intelligent life during a 1961 meeting here. And now, O'Neill says, a massive 2,000 hours a year of telescope time is going to the SETI project Breakthrough Listen, an effort to repeatedly observe many star systems searching for signs of intelligence.
Truly one of the hardest questions to ask is to look for a signal you have no idea what it's going to look like at a frequency you have no idea where it's going to come in at, and then to try to say, I think I've got one. So it's a very, very difficult problem. It's a very, very challenging problem. It's a very, very fun problem to try to do.
But Earth brings additional challenges to that search, technical challenges caused by humans.
The energy given off by a single snowflake hitting the ground is much more powerful than the radio signal that the astronomer is trying to receive. So any man-made transmitter, electronic device, unintentional transmitter, basically overwhelms the usable signal for the observer.
The problem is particularly acute when it comes to looking for SETI signals, because researchers are looking for transmissions that might be very like signals from our own earthly technology, just a lot farther away. The lack of radio reception on my drive into town was because the observatory lies in a national radio quiet zone that strictly regulates transmissions. Close to the telescopes, electronics use is restricted even more. Only diesel engines are allowed past a toll gate at the observatory because the spark plugs in regular gas engines give off too much electrical noise. On a tour of the site, I have to turn my recorder off before it goes anywhere near the front side of the telescope. And digital cameras also make too much radio noise. I have to pick up a disposable film camera to get some snapshots. And forget about the can-you-hear-me-now guy. Cell phones are supposed to be turned off and left in your vehicle by the front gate.
The radio astronomer unit of measurement is called a Jansky. And a Jansky is 10 to the minus 26 watts per square meter per hertz. The GBT is operating in millijanskys. Your cell phone that may operate at 1 watt, let's say, when it transmits or is trying to handshake with a tower, is a billion, billion, million times more powerful than the signal that the radio astronomer is trying to receive.
And there's definitely no Wi-Fi in the dorm rooms.
Absolutely the biggest challenge in today's world for us is Wi-Fi. Wi-Fi modems, Wi-Fi everything. You know, cars now are Wi-Fi hotspots. So vehicles that are traveling up and down the main road are just transmitters, you know, at 2.4 gigahertz. 2.4 gigahertz, unfortunately, is the prime band for pulsar observations.
He's planted the frontage of the property with a stand of pine trees, hoping to damp down interference from passing cars. The grounds are studded with weird-looking sculptures of metal pipe. They're actually sensors to monitor for radio interference. And there's a van that can hunt for sources of interference, maybe someone's home Wi-Fi network, or the automatic door opener at the new grocery store down the road. But so many things have some kind of wireless connection these days, and the problem is getting worse.
Everyone is so connected at these frequencies with every device. You know, 20 years ago wasn't even a concern. These days, it's a major concern for radio astronomy. How to mitigate that, you know, has been a challenge that I'm not sure we can win.
In other words, he's hoping that the first signs of extraterrestrial intelligence won't be drowned out by someone streaming Arrival on their iPad. In Greenbank, West Virginia, I'm Charles Bergquist for Science Friday.
When you're hunting for extraterrestrial intelligence, how do you even start to look? And how do you know what to look for when you have no idea what life elsewhere might look like or the technology it might use? Joining me now is Andrew Simeon, Scientific Director of the Breakthrough Listen Project based at the University of California at Berkeley. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, Ira. Thank you very much for having me.
You're quite welcome. So tell me, Andrew, what exactly do you look for?
Well, basically what we look for in Breakthrough Listen and really in any SETI experiment is the kind of electromagnetic emission that we know can only arise from technology. So we have lots of examples of technology here on this planet that show us what kind of emission technology can produce. And from many decades of astronomy and indeed radio astronomy, we know the kinds of emission that the natural world produces. And these kinds of emission are very different. So we look for the kind of emission that we know to only arise from technology.
Hmm. Is there a narrow band that you're looking for? I heard in Charles's piece that, you know, it's the worst possible place to put your Wi-Fi. And that was the 2.4 gigahertz band. But where do you look for it?
So we try to search as much of the electromagnetic spectrum as we possibly can. We have lots of different types of technology on this planet. We have radio technology like Wi-Fi routers and cell phones, but we also have optical technology like lasers that also produces emission that's very different from the natural world. So we try to search as much of the spectrum as we possibly can with many different kinds of telescopes.
So you got four different kinds of telescopes here?
Well, in the Breakthrough Listen program, we have two different types of telescopes, radio telescopes and optical telescopes, and we're also looking at some infrared and high-energy observatories as well. But basically, the idea with all of these telescopes is the same. We're looking for this particular type of electromagnetic emission, be it radio signals or optical signals or other, that we know only arises from technology.
And how many people are involved in the total search?
Well, worldwide, SETI probably has about 50 or 60 people that practice it at least half-time. Our team at Berkeley is made up of about a dozen people that work primarily on the Breakthrough Listen program.
Mm-hmm. And you must produce a ton of data from all the searching.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. So the kinds of signals that we're looking for with a radio telescope require us to record the most rawest possible data product that a radio telescope can produce. And the data rate that we see at the Greenbank Observatory, for example, is several hundred gigabits per second. That's about a petabyte of data over 24 hours. So it's really an absolutely massive, massive data rate. And of course, we want to search that for many different types of signal. So it's a real computational challenge in addition to everything else.
A petabyte is 1,000 gigabytes?
A million gigabytes.
That's right.
1,000 terabytes. So about 1,000 modern laptop computers every 24 hours that we observe.
You ever ask the public, maybe they could join in, you know, crowdsource it out there?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a program that we operate in our group at Berkeley called SETI at Home. And this is actually an application that you can download from our website. And when that application wakes up on your computer, it will download a little bit of the data from our computers at Berkeley and actually do the very computationally intensive analysis necessary to search for signals using your home computer.
Hmm. How is all this being processed? Do you have fancy algorithms and things like that?
So fundamentally, the kind of signal that we look for in SETI, for the most part, be it in radio or optical, is a large amount of electromagnetic energy concentrated at just one wavelength or one electromagnetic frequency. And with radio telescopes, we look for those kinds of signals using something called a Fourier transform, which many of your listeners are probably familiar with. This is just a way of breaking down a signal that varies in time to one that varies in frequency or in wavelength. With optical telescopes, we use basically prisms or diffraction gratings, very, very accurate spectrographs that break optical light down into all of its constituent colors. And we look for a signal that's only occurring at one color, which is something that we know that the natural world does not do.
Yeah. Do you have any odds of people, you know, the bookies making any odds that you're going to find something?
Yeah, that's a fun question. I don't know that any of the bookies formally have odds on the SETI search. That would be fun if they did. I think when we talk about this over a couple of pints after work, the odds range from maybe a few percent to maybe a few hundredths or thousandths of a percent. But this is, in fact, the most difficult question. We don't know whether or not there is other life elsewhere in the universe, and we don't know whether or not there's other intelligent life.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about the Breakthrough Listens Project. Dr. Andrew Simeone is the project director for Breakthrough Listen at the University of California, Berkeley. We have a tweet from Daniel Yount who says, hey, moon base on the dark side of the moon for searching for remote signals. Put a receiver there, right? You'll screen out all that interference.
Yeah, it's a fantastic idea. It's actually an idea that's been around in SETI for some time. So as we heard in that piece about the Green Bank Telescope, the biggest challenge in a radio SETI experiment is telling the difference between terrestrial technology, our own communication systems, and an extraterrestrial technology, something coming from a distant extrasolar planet. And a good way of getting away from our own terrestrial technology is, of course, to go to space and perhaps to build a large radio observatory on the dark side of the moon, shielded from the Earth by the moon itself.
And it would be, because it's turning, it would actually start rotate, you know, and scan a lot of the sky.
Yeah, that's right. So we would probably steer such a telescope digitally because it would be very expensive, of course, to build a telescope on the moon. But this would be something that would be quite expensive to do and for now is only in our wildest dreams.
Yeah, because that would take a lot more money than you have, I'm guessing.
Yeah, that would be a very expensive proposition, I think, to build a base of any kind on the moon. But there's quite a lot of interest, actually, in astronomy generally about having radio observatories and other kinds of astronomical observatories on the moon. So perhaps this is something that might be in humanity's future.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about this? Because you're searching because you believe that there's got to be extraterrestrial life out there, intelligent life, or you wouldn't be looking for it. As part of your mission, do you think about how you break the news if you actually come up with something?
Yeah, that's something that I personally don't spend a whole lot of time thinking about. Maybe for 5 or 10 minutes right before I go to bed, I think about what we might do if we actually found a signal. But indeed, we believe and most believe that it would be among the most amazing and awe-inspiring discoveries that we could make as scientists or as human beings to discover that there is other intelligent life, other communicative life elsewhere in the universe. And it's very difficult to predict how the world would react to that. But I think, personally, I think it would be a very positive reaction. I think it would be a very unifying moment.
Yeah, because it has religious, ethical, all kinds of different problems, you know. And even there are some people who are even concerned that we let other people know that we're here. And if you've got signs of intelligent life, would you then say, hey, let's return? Let's make a signal that we send back to say, hey, we're here. Is that part of the idea?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. So in the SETI enterprise, we only listen for signals. We're simply trying to determine whether or not there is other intelligent life out there. But indeed, if we did discover a signal, many would ask the question, should we respond to it? And personally, I think that that's a question that should involve the entire planet. The relationship between the life on Earth, human life on Earth, and life on other worlds is something that involves the entire planet, and it's something that we should all weigh in on before we responded.
Okay, I'm going to give you the blank check question I'd like to give out. I don't actually have one to give you, but if you had one, where would you spend the money? What do you need most?
Well, I think in general, the most important thing for the field of SETI is to help to develop a healthy ecosystem of researchers in the field. SETI is a field that I think has been characterized by not continuous funding, by sporadic funding, funding that at times has involved governments and has involved private individuals. And most recently, Breakthrough Listen with the Breakthrough Prize Foundation has seen a really phenomenal contribution of funding towards the field that will go for at least another 10 years or so. But I think one thing that the SETI field has faced in the past is a lack of an ecosystem of graduate students and postdocs and young mm-hmm. faculty that are working in the field because of the sporadic funding.
Well, maybe people listening here will be motivated. Andrew Simeone, Scientific Director of the Breakthrough Listen Project based at the University of California at Berkeley. Thank you for being with us today. When we come back, we're going to talk about Lyme disease. You think you might know all about it, but you're going to be surprised to hear what our Lyme disease experts say. It's the Lyme disease season, so we'll talk about it right after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you live in the bucolic areas of New England or the upper Midwest, you probably know that the price of living so close to nature is ticks that carry Lyme disease. In fact, the name Lyme comes from Old Lyme, Connecticut. New York, Connecticut, Minnesota, Martha's Vineyard, all of these places are ground zero for a Lyme disease epidemic that has been in full swing for several decades now. And despite the fact that the disease is so familiar to those of us who live in these areas, there are many misconceptions about Lyme that can be pretty dangerous. For instance, Lyme disease is most commonly associated with deer, you know, that other nuisance that comes with living near the woods. But ticks actually pick up Lyme disease from infected mice. And did you know that the bullseye rash that comes with a tick bite sometimes doesn't always appear? And that means it's possible that you could have Lyme disease even if you never saw the bullseye, you didn't have one, and you thought you were safe. And the reason we don't know as much as we think we do about Lyme disease is because it's much more complicated than it appears. The bacteria have to learn to survive in their hosts. Species have to interact in a very specific way for the disease to be transmitted. And once it gets into the body, well, that's maybe the biggest mystery of all, one that scientists are still working to solve. And joining me to help clarify some of the mysteries of Lyme disease are my guests. John Aucott, Assistant Professor of Medicine and Director of the Lyme Disease Research Center at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Welcome to Science Friday.
Great to be here.
Thank you. Felicia Kiesing is Professor of Biology at Bard College. Dr. Kiesing, welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on again.
And if our listeners have any questions, the number 844-724-8255 is our number. Let's talk about if you grew up around here the last 30 years, you've heard about Lyme disease. We think we understand it, but not everyone has all the correct information, Dr. Kiesing. Tell us, for example, we associate Lyme disease with deer, but the bacteria doesn't come from the deer, right?
Right. The deer aren't responsible for infecting the ticks. The ticks actually, the important thing to know is that when the ticks are first hatching out of the eggs, they don't have the bacterium at all. They have to pick it up by feeding on a host that's infected with the Lyme bacterium. And different host species, it could be a mouse or a squirrel or a chipmunk or a fox, each of those different species has a different probability of transmitting the Lyme bacterium to the feeding tick. And the host that's most responsible, the host that's best at doing that, is the white-footed mouse by far. About 90% of ticks that feed on a white-footed mouse will pick up the infection, but deer really don't transmit the Lyme bacterium at all.
Interesting. John Aucott, there's something we thought we knew about Lyme disease in people that we're finding out that is not quite right, and that is the classic bullseye around the tick bite. Doesn't always happen, right?
That's correct. I mean, actually, the majority of the skin lesions are uniformly round and red. They don't have that ring within a ring Target department store look to them. People often mistaken them for spider bites because they're just round or oval and red, sometimes even bluish red.
So how can you tell if you have been bitten? What's the best way to know?
Yeah, and the best way still is education of both patients and physicians about the range of appearances of the rash. So we always want to educate people to look for any round or oval skin lesion, you know, that's bigger than 2 or 3 inches. So education is the first thing for sure. And then also telling people that not everyone has a rash. So that summer flu-like illness with a fever and achiness and chills in June, July in a Lyme endemic area could likely be Lyme disease.
Because it's really hard to see the tick, isn't it?
Well, that's right. Only about 30% of people that get Lyme disease saw the tick that gave it to them, because the tick is about the size of a pinhead, the nymph stage that are feeding in the spring and summer. So most people, it's actually easier to feel them than to see them.
All right, let me give out our number, 844-724-8255, if you'd like to talk about it. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Do you see many patients who have lived a long time with undiagnosed Lyme disease because they never saw the bullseye?
We do see some, and that's because without antibiotic treatment, the bacteria has learned how to evade the immune system and can persist for months or even years if it's not been treated with antibiotics. So we see people with late arthritis from Lyme disease, and those people have been infected sometimes for a year or longer before they come to diagnosis and treatment.
Could Lyme disease have been around a lot longer than we know it's been here and have existed for centuries and we just didn't know it?
Well, I think there is some evidence that, you know, ticks that have been recovered from storage have the bacteria in them. So it's probably just one of those diseases that didn't appear visibly until the last few decades. That's right.
And could we have been misdiagnosing it all these years and saying it was one thing and it was really something, Lyme disease, what we didn't know about?
In North America, at least, you know, the disease really did emerge in the late 70s and 80s, and that had to do with environmental changes that favored, you know, the proliferation of infected ticks. So I think there was actually an environmental reason why the disease emerged in the late 1970s.
And do we have a diagnostic test, a really positive test that will tell you if you get the test that you've had it or have it now?
So the current diagnostic test is based on antibody production. Those antibodies take about 2 or 3 weeks to be formed, so the test does not work well in the first 2 weeks of infection when you want to try to make that earliest diagnosis. After 2 or 3 weeks of infection, then the antibodies form, and then the test starts to work better. But there is this gap in the first couple of weeks where the test does not perform well.
And there is some controversy with this disease, the fact that Lyme doesn't always look the same in people the way it does in the medical literature, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're, you know, textbooks, patients don't always read the textbooks, you know, so they don't know what they're supposed to look like. And so, you know, as a clinician, I certainly recognize that there's a lot of variability beyond what the textbooks describe, that's for sure.
Dr. Kiesing, how long does it take to infect a person? I think that's also some mythology there that we don't really know. Most of the public doesn't know.
So usually a tick, it takes a few days for the tick to feed on you before the Lyme bacterium mobilize from the tick and actually make their way into your body. So for Lyme disease, as long as you get the tick off within a couple of days, you're usually okay.
So you mean the tick can actually stay on your body that long?
Yeah, ticks feed for several days.
Wow.
They're sort of remarkable because each tick lives for about 2 years, so that's their maximum lifespan. But during that entire 2 year period, they only feed 3 times. So, you know, feeding for a couple of days seems reasonable if that's one of your 3 meals in your 2 year lifespan.
So what are the other 2 meals?
Well, it's the same thing. So they hatch out, as I said before, they hatch out uninfected with the bacterium. And they go through 3 life stages from that point. So they start out as a larva. They take a single blood meal as a larva, then they molt into the nymphal stage, take their second meal as a nymph, molt into the adult stage, and then take their final meal. And that all plays out over a 3-year period, with each of the meals taking just a couple of days. The rest of the time, the ticks are living down in the soil, and we never see them.
I talked with John about the discovery of the disease. Why was Lyme disease discovered emerged only about 30 years ago?
Well, you know, a lot of people think that, we know that it's been around for a very long time, and one guess is that the symptoms are generalizable enough that it took people a while to figure out that this was something distinct from, you know, just sort of general malaise and flu-like symptoms. But there's also some pretty good evidence that we've done things to landscapes around the country, particularly in the Northeast and the Upper Midwest, that have led to increases in the amount of infection in ticks.
Mm-hmm. Of course, you would think that this has generated a lot of phone calls, so we're going to try to go to a few of them. Let's go to Mary Jane in Oakland. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
I have more of a comment than a question. I was bitten by a tick in California in 1989 or 90, and I was not diagnosed until 2003. So saying that people usually get diagnosed within a year is absurd, and at least in this part of the country. I think if you're in Connecticut or New York, you're better off. But out here, they tend to ascribe the progressing symptoms, which are different from person to person, in in most cases to just being a little hypochondriacal or a little nutsy. And so getting someone, a doctor, who will listen to the ridiculous list of symptoms that people suffer is like finding gold in your backyard.
That's interesting.
So, yeah, and you know what I'm saying is really common.
Let me get some comment. Let me get some comments. I've heard it from other people. Dr. Alcott or Kee Singh, what do you, have you got to say about that?
Well, I'm very sympathetic to the caller because, you know, as this disease has moved geographically, it's kind of a moving front. You know, it started up in Lyme, Connecticut, New England, but as it moves south and north, each new area each year is kind of new to the disease, so the learning curve for physicians and patients both kind of restarts as it moves into new areas. So it's no longer just along the coast of the East Coast. It's moved westward across Pennsylvania and New York. So as it moves, we have to re-educate physicians and patients. And I'm very sympathetic to the caller. There still is a lot of misdiagnosis of Lyme disease. It can be a tricky diagnosis when it doesn't have its kind of textbook manifestation.
And what about the accepted treatment? What is the standard treatment for it now?
So the standard treatment is antibiotics. This is a bacterial infection, and the standard treatment is with antibiotics. There are a subset of people, that's actually what we study at the Hopkins Lyme Center, that after antibiotic treatment still have persistent symptoms, and those people are more challenging to understand and to treat because we don't understand right now why this small subset of people that have post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome still have the symptoms even after the antibiotic treatment.
Speaking about that, here's a tweet from BW asks, after antibiotic treatment for Lyme, is it important to follow up with another blood test?
So unfortunately, the blood test doesn't directly measure the bacterial infection, the Borrelia burgdorferi bacteria. The currently available blood test that's commonly used measures antibodies, and that test does not correlate with a treatment of cure. So unfortunately, we don't really have a treatment of cure right now because we're not able to re-measure the bacterial infection itself. We're relying on these antibodies, which are made by your immune system, and they persist for long periods of time after the infection's gone.
I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Why don't we have better tests for Lyme disease? Why?
The bacteria Borrelia burgdorferi is very difficult to study and to do research on. This is a bacteria that's related to the syphilis bacteria, and that bacteria we still haven't learned how to grow in culture yet. So this isn't a bacteria like staph or strep that you can easily work with in a laboratory and easily cultivate. So it's a tough organism to do research on, and that's really slowed the ability to come up with new diagnostic tests. We're working on it, but it's a difficult challenge.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones to Denver, to Max in Denver. Hi, Max.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call.
Hi, go ahead.
So I'm a Bard College alumni myself. And definitely people in that part of the country, up in upstate New York and the upper Midwest, they're well aware of the symptoms of Lyme disease, and they know to be cautious. I was wondering if the experts here could comment if there was any coordinated effort for people that are vacationing, say, in the upper Midwest or vacationing in New England, if there was any coordinated effort to keep them informed and up to date to look for the symptoms of Lyme disease and to check for ticks.
And the kind of clothing that they should be wearing. Good question. Thanks for that question. Felicia or John, any follow-up?
I can say that in a lot of natural areas where you'd expect to have relatively high rates of encounter with ticks, people have petitioned to have communities put up signage that warns against ticks and tells people how to dress themselves properly and how to do a tick check, but those are certainly not everywhere they could be. So I think visitors are particularly vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. David in University Park, Maryland. Hi, David.
Good afternoon. I have three short questions. First, is there a way to detect the prevalence by examining the host? That is, are the hosts asymptomatic or do they show signs that can be detected? Second, what antibiotics are most effective, and is there any development of resistance to those antibiotics yet? And third, if this disease were better known, would there be better funding, or is funding not a problem?
Okay, thanks. We'll see how many we can get. What about the host, the mice?
I can do that.
Yes, go ahead.
So that's interesting. We're just finishing up a big research project asking that very question about the mice, which are the hosts most responsible for infecting the ticks here in the East. And they basically show no symptoms whatsoever. We've measured their behavior, their survival, the number of babies they have, what roles they play in the forest, and we see essentially no effects. So at least for mice, they do not appear to be a pathogen the way that they are for us. There are some other hosts that do respond to them, including some people's pets, right, which is one of the reasons that people are so vigilant about ticks on their pets. But at least on their most important host out in the wild, the white-footed mouse, those appear to be asymptomatic.
And the answer to the other question, why if there are more people with it, would we have more research into it?
You know, there are plenty of people with it. There's 300,000 or more new cases every year. So this really ranks as the top, what we call a vector-borne illness, one transmitted by ticks or insects. It's a hugely first-place disease. So there's a lot of illness. So we obviously need more funding into the research. One of the areas that he brought up is antibiotic resistance. It's hard to study because you can't culture the organism, and if you can't culture the organism, then you can't do resistance testing. So that's an example of where we need funding for research.
That's all the time we have. A very interesting and timely topic. John Aucott, Assistant Professor of Medicine and Director of the Lyme Disease Research Center, Johns Hopkins University, and Felicia Kiesing, Professor of Biology at Bard College. She joined us via Skype. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. And if you're curious about more, shall we say, unconventional approach to tackling Lyme, look out for the new Science Friday podcast coming out called Undiscovered. We're launching it on May 9th, and in one episode, our reporter Annie Minoff heads to Martha's Vineyard to hear about a proposal to get rid of Lyme on the island by making a better mouse. That's coming up this May, our new podcast, Undiscovered. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks, as always, to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.